U.S. v. Medina, 17-1455.
Good morning. May it please the Court. I'm Anthony Noble, and I represent the appellant, Delano Medina. The issue before this Court is whether Mr. Medina was denied his constitutional right to a speedy trial. The indictment was returned in October of 2014, and then there was a superseding indictment that was returned in June 2015. However, Mr. Medina was not brought into federal court until January of 2017. So that was more than 2 years from the original indictment and about 19 months from the superseding indictment. So because of that delay in the filing of the indictments and bringing Mr. Medina into federal court, there is presumptive prejudice. And what that does is that triggers an inquiry into the four-part test under Barker versus Wingo. So Mr. Medina was given a hearing on whether or not he was denied his constitutional right to a speedy trial. And the court considered the four factors under Barker. The first factor was the length of the delay, and the court found that this was a substantial delay of more than 2 years, and therefore that factor weighed in favor of Mr. Medina. The second factor was the reason for the delay, and the court found that that somewhat weighed in favor of Mr. Medina because the government had no reason for waiting for his other cases to be resolved before bringing him.
They stated a very good reason. You can't try them all together. They had issued writs twice, and the defendant already moved. During this period of time, he was transferred 17 times between courts. So you've got to stop somewhere. And after these difficulties, they went last. They had not received any notice that he had demanded a speedy trial. He had sent a letter to the warden or something saying, please notify the district court. That had never gotten to the federal prosecutors. As soon as they got the notice, they issued a writ within a week or so, I think. Seems to me that's a pretty good reason.
Well, first, Your Honor, it's the government's burden to bring a defendant into court in a timely manner. So regardless of whether or not they got notice, they had that burden.
And that makes a lot of sense in most contexts. In fact, that makes terrific sense in almost any context. Yeah. This is really unusual.
It is an unusual case, and the district court recognized that it was an unusual case. But first, the district court didn't accept the government's reason for the delay because the court found that that was inconsistent with issuing the detainer and issuing the two writs. And then
we can't review that. I don't quite understand the district court's reasoning in that regard. Why was that inconsistent? They tried a couple times. They found that they discovered this guy's moving around all the time, and so they just watched and brought it promptly when the defendant requested it.
Yes, it was inconsistent because by issuing the detainer and issuing the writs, that shows an intention that they want to bring him into court as soon as they can. But then the other comment that the district court made in finding that factor weighs in favor of Mr. Medina was that he had, 10 or 11 pending cases, and every other jurisdiction managed to bring him into court and resolve those cases within a reasonable amount of time. And the government didn't give any particular reason why they should be at the end of the line, why they should wait for all of the other jurisdictions.
Somebody's got to be last, right?
Yeah, but why? Why does it have to be?
So whoever is last has denied him his right to a speedy trial.
Well, not necessarily.
Whichever jurisdiction says, this is really messy, I'm not going to add to the mess, we're not going to add to the mess. Whatever jurisdiction decides that has violated the right to a speedy trial?
Well, not necessarily. If they'd made the attempt, they could have brought him in and every other case could have been resolved in time as well.
They made two attempts, didn't they?
Yes, there were two writs that were issued, and there was the detainer as well. But what the district court found was that, every other jurisdiction managed to bring him in and resolve his cases. And then when you look at the 11 pending cases in addition to this federal case, Only two of them went to trial. All the others were resolved by guilty pleas, I presume. So it's not as if, you know, there would have been any disruption by the federal government bringing him into court within a timely manner. So the district court was correct in finding that that factor weighs somewhat in favor of Mr. Benita. But even if you accept the government's argument, all they're asking for is that you should consider that as a neutral factor, not necessarily weighing in favor of the government.
Is that be considered neutral?
I think that that's what the government said in their answer brief, that you should either consider it neutral, a neutral factor.
But do you think it should weigh against the government? Are you agreeing with the government? Both sides agree that's a neutral factor.
Your Honor, when you look at all four factors, I don't think it really matters whether it's neutral or whether it weighs somewhat in his favor.
Okay.
Because, you know, the most important of the factors is really the prejudice. So it doesn't really, you know, tip the balance either way.
Okay.
But then coming to the third factor, the assertion of the right, the court found that, you know, that weighs strongly in Mr. Medina's favor. Mr. Medina did present quite a few exhibits that were stipulated to by the government at the evidentiary hearing, which showed his efforts to try and find out what the federal case was about and to try and assert his right to a speedy trial in this case. And then the fourth factor, which is really the most important factor, is the prejudice to Mr. Medina. And this is really the main issue on appeal, is whether or not Mr. Medina did establish that he was prejudiced by this lengthy delay in bringing him into federal court. And out of the three interests that the Supreme Court has identified under the constitutional right to a speedy trial, the most important one really is the impairments or hindrance of the defense. And Mr. Medina's main argument here is that during the 2 year or more delay in bringing him into federal court, his cell phone was lost or went missing. And his cell phone had a huge amount of data on it, which could have established where he was at specific times and supported an alibi defense. And this is where the court found that he didn't make a particularized showing of prejudice, that he didn't show exactly how his phone would have helped his alibi defense. And what he was arguing both at the evidentiary hearing and in subsequent pleadings was his phone contained a lot of photographs that he was taking, that he was with his girlfriend, they were traveling around the state, and they were taking photographs every day, and the photographs would have identified the time and the date and the location and would have provided an alibi defense to at least charges 2 through 12. And this is where the district court didn't find that there was any prejudice as a result of losing the cell phone. And it was in a motion for reconsideration that Mr. Medina explained that, referring to the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Riley versus California about how a cell phone can track pretty much, you know, the history of a person because you have it in your pocket. It tracks the GPS coordinates. It can track the location. It's something that law enforcement uses to prove that a defendant was in a certain place at a certain time. And in the same way, it can be used by a defendant to prove that he was in a certain place at a certain time.
Counsel, could I just ask you to clarify some procedural history in terms of what you've just been talking about? So there was an evidentiary hearing on this issue, and afterwards the district court denied the motion.
That's correct.
And then there was a request for reconsideration.
That's correct.
And the court again denied that.
Yes.
And then this is where I need your help. After that, Mr. Medina submitted a supplemental filing pro se, where he goes into some additional detail about what was on the phone and how that might have helped. Did the court react to that filing?
No, Your Honor. What happened was after the denial of the motion for reconsideration, Mr. Medina did file a second motion to dismiss based on a constitutional speedy trial violation, and then he filed two briefs in support of that motion. And then at sentencing as well, he provided the court with further information about his attempts to track down one of the witnesses and to try and track down the information from the cell phone company. But the court did not rule on his second motion to dismiss and the briefs or anything that followed afterwards. Now, I suppose your question is that now preserved for appeal? Is that something that you can review? And I think that the answer to that question is yes, because what you have to do is look at the plea agreement. And in the plea agreement, he waived his right to appeal with the exception of the constitutional speedy trial issue. And it wasn't just the original motion that he preserved for appeal, but it was all of his motions. And that's one thing that I think is first clarified in the plea agreement itself, where I think that there's an alteration that instead of motion, it talks about motions. But then at the change of plea hearing as well, there was a comment about the supplemental briefs that Mr. Medina had filed, and that's where the government essentially said, you know, don't worry, they're preserved for appeal too. So I think that, you know, the fact that his plea was entered under his understanding that he was preserving everything that he had filed for appellate review, that's open for your review.
Well, that helps me pretty much with my question, but there's one last piece of it which has to do with, apart from preservation, is there a problem that the court didn't make yet another ruling on the issue after the supplemental information had been presented? I mean, after all, the motion had been denied, motion for reconsideration denied, but in the absence of some action by the court on this additional information, what are we supposed to do with that? The fact that we don't have anything formally entered by the court in response to that?
Well, Your Honor, I think that if you're not able to resolve the appeal based on the court's rulings, but you believe that the assertions and the allegations in his supplemental motions would warrant relief, if he could prove it, then I should imagine that the remedy there would be to remand for an evidentiary hearing so that he can prove those allegations and prove his denial of his constitutional right to a speedy trial. And if the court has no further questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Let me ask a question about the cell phone, because my understanding was the judge found he wasn't prejudiced by loss of the cell phone in two ways. One, he really hadn't shown that there was useful evidence on the phone. But second, I thought the judge also considered where the cell phone had been, because it was admitted that he had the cell phone well for a significant period after the charges were filed. They were in a safe with a sister or something, and then it somehow disappeared from that safe. It had never been given to defense counsel. How do you respond to that part of the problem?
Well, this superseding indictment was filed in June 2015, and then the cell phone went missing in October or November 2015. And
I think superseding? Why do we look at the superseding as opposed to the original?
Because the cell phone really relates to the defenses, to the counts in the superseding indictment rather than the original indictment. So I think that you're correct that the court did assign some fault to Mr. Medina for not being able to secure his cell phone, you know, once he had been aware of the allegations. But his position is that he didn't become aware of the counts in the superseding indictment until he was brought into federal court in January of 2017. And I don't think there's any evidence to show that he was aware of those counts prior to then. So unless the court has
And the
no
cell phone code. Wouldn't have been relevant to the other charges in the multiple other jurisdictions?
It may have been, but there's no record. I don't think there's any record of that in the record before this court.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
May it please the Court. Please. Gareth Winstead on behalf of the United States. There are essentially two main points in this case that are important. Those are the reason for the delay and the prejudice to the defendant. Obviously, the discussion up to this point has to some degree acknowledged that. With regard to the final point made by defense counsel, there is a reason to evaluate some fault by the defendant for not preserving the phone, because at the hearing, the evidence that was submitted through testimony from the grandmother was that the defendant was very concerned about the phone, that he knew its importance, and that he was, she testified, checking up on it on a weekly basis. And therefore, the argument that he only knew the phone was important after learning of the charges in the superseding indictment doesn't really match with that evidence.
Which factor does your point go to?
Yes, Your Honor, that's as to the defendant's failure to carry his burden to establish prejudice. So that's under the prejudice factor.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. With regard to the Court's questions about the nature of the record and the appropriateness of evaluating the vast list of allegations that the defendant made throughout the course of the case, it is true that there was a hearing and the district court ruled on motions and evidence from that hearing, and that after that, the defendant filed a motion for reconsideration, but that motion was resolved procedurally because the defendant hadn't satisfied the necessary requirements for reconsideration, not substantively. And then all of the subsequent filings by the defendant where he made further allegations or specifications regarding prejudice, all of them were dismissed as moot during the plea hearing. Now, they're certainly part of the record, but there is no ruling from the district court on any of those things, and therefore they're really not properly before this court in evaluating the district court's decision to deny the defendant's motion to dismiss.
Just to be clear then, this supplemental brief, for example, that he filed pro se in September, what you're telling us is that we're not supposed to look at that, we're not supposed to consider that in our evaluation of prejudice. We're supposed to ignore that.
Essentially, yes, Your Honor. It is, again, that was not part of the things that the district court made its ruling on, and that ruling is what's being appealed. At no point did the defendant bring up the failure of the district court to rule on those motions, and that issue was also not appealed. And therefore, anything subsequent to really the hearing, because even the motions to reconsider and the reply on the motion to reconsider were not dealt with substantively, but were dealt with procedurally. All of those matters are not what the district court had before it when it made its decision to deny the defendant's motion. Given that limitation, during the motions hearing, the defendant essentially solely provided evidence that of aspects of prejudice that have since been abandoned. And then as regards the cell phone, which is really the only allegation of prejudice that is being appealed, with regard to the cell phone, the only evidence regarding it is that the grandmother testified Medina had said that the phone had important photos and videos on it, but no content about how they related to his defense. And then a couple statements in argument by defense counsel or by the defendant himself, that essentially it had pictures and videos that could have substantiated the defendant's alibi. There's no specification about how that could be done, about what the alibi is, or anything of that nature.
I'm sorry, go ahead and finish your thought.
And then the subsequent statement just specified that the messages and videos were date-stamped with dates and times that would have been exculpatory. But again, that does not satisfy the defendant's burden. The in order to establish prejudice, a defendant must present evidence of what that prejudice is. And that evidence has to show what the nature of the evidence would have been, that it's unavailable, why it became unavailable, and most importantly, how it relates to his defense. Because
So you're saying he should have said, I was in Grand Junction on that date, nowhere near the crime, and we took pictures. Is that what you're saying he had to produce? Or do you think even that wouldn't have been enough?
No, Your Honor, that is the sort of thing that courts have held sufficient to establish that burden. And the purpose for holding the defendant to that kind of a burden is, without some understanding of what the evidence would have been, and how it was lost, and how important it is to a defense, there's no way to accord meaningful weight to that in undergoing the balancing test. And so it needs to be sufficient for a court to have a meaningful understanding of just how important it is and that it was lost due to the delay.
You had an argument about some of his lost evidence that he hadn't shown it couldn't be recovered. Are you making any argument that even the pictures and videos could have been recovered without the phone?
Well, it's unclear, Your Honor. And again, that goes back to the lack of specificity in the defendant's showing. So obviously, subsequently on the record, there's further discussion about there was discussion about a Facebook account. There's discussion about Gmail messages and text messages and all that sort of thing. But all that does is serve to highlight that when someone uses a modern cell phone, there are many ways in which that information can be retrieved other than on the physical device.
Wasn't there a 2-year limit, though, on the cell tower data? And he makes the argument that he would have been able to show, either from the phone or from the cell tower data, that he wasn't, he wasn't in Durango, as one of the charges alleged. Could you address that specific argument?
Absolutely, Your Honor. So again, all of those allegations essentially come in later pleadings that my argument should not be part of this court's consideration. Nevertheless, there's a couple points on that. When he does make those allegations, he says things like, Ms. Sears and I took photographs together of ourselves showing where we were, right? He makes no showing about why then Ms. Sears couldn't have testified about it as a way of establishing that same defense, or why the photographs or videos themselves would have been absolutely...
I don't think this was about photographs and videos. I think it's just the pinging off the towers, and now that apparently the provider doesn't keep that data for more than 2 years, and so he says that he can't get that through an alternative source. I think that was the argument, not that there were pictures or videos.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, as to that argument, again, he really makes that showing in subsequent pleadings, such as an affidavit and some exhibits that he files at the time of sentencing. During the hearing, the evidence that he offers is a track phone evidence that goes to his ability to find the phone, not his ability to recover any of the data that's on the phone. But further point to that is that when he makes those allegations subsequently in later filings, he talks about, again, not being in Durango, for instance. Well, in this case, the counts that relate to those particular allegations that he wasn't in Durango, for instance, well, that relates to count 4, which was dismissed. And I think it's absolutely appropriate for this court to look at, to the degree any of those more specific allegations are considered, to look at the ultimate resolution of this case in evaluating whether there ended up being prejudice, because counts 4 through 12 were all dismissed as part of the plea agreement. And the only counts that he even says that his alibi relates to that he ended up pleading guilty to are count 2 and count 3. Those counts, again, both take place in February and March, which are before the time frame that he alleges he was taking pictures with Ms. Sears. He alleges that from May to December. And so again, even were this court to evaluate those later allegations of prejudice, and even were this court to give some weight to the fact that he was more specific, they still don't go to any of the counts of conviction.
Just curious, though, can a defendant in his position make the argument that the absence of the phone hindered the ability to make a defense to various charges, even though they might have been dismissed as part of the plea agreement, that he had his phone and enabled to mount a defense, he wouldn't have entered the plea agreement in the first place. So are those dismissed charges really, does that settle the issue? I mean, I don't know if you have a case that helps us on something like that.
Only the fact that in Frias, this court did resolve one of the allegations of prejudice in light of the ultimate resolution of the case. It was an allegation about not being able to take advantage of early parole or something like that, and the court stated, in light of the ultimate resolution of the federal case, this wasn't prejudicial. And so I don't think that it's a clean, it's something that a defendant can certainly argue, and it's not a clean resolution, but it certainly is something that should go into this court's weighing of the weight of that prejudice, which again, this court should only get to if it believes that his allegations of prejudice were specific enough to even meet the initial burden. Moving to the reason for the delay, in this case, the district court found that the reason for the delay weighed against the United States, and I believe that that was an incorrect holding, that the evidence, in fact, established that this should weigh in favor of the United States. This is a case where there were 11 state cases in 8 different jurisdictions that were all simultaneously being pursued by different sovereignties. And that does set this case outside of the ordinary course because, of course, the defendant has a Sixth Amendment right in every single one of those cases, including the federal case. And all of the cases proceeded at a very good clip. In just about 3 years from the time of the federal indictment to the time of the sentencing, almost all of those cases were resolved, including 2 trials and numerous motions. When evaluating how much of that total 3-year delay to attribute to the United States or to the defendant, because, of course, any delay attributable to the defendant doesn't weigh against the United States, it's important to note that one of those cases was a case that the defendant had absconded from sentencing in February of 2014. And so that case was still pending and was only being resolved during the course of this because the defendant himself had prevented that from being resolved back in early 2014.
So if we agree with you on the reason for delay argument, how does that affect, or does it affect, the prejudice analysis?
Well, Your Honor, I believe it does because even if this court finds that the defendant satisfied his burden to show that there was some prejudice, this court should look at the weight of that prejudice and the fact that the defendant did talk about many witnesses that he could potentially have called to substantiate some of his alibis that he wished to bring, that the majority of those accounts that he even alleged an alibi to were dismissed, and that instead the reason for the delay weighs heavily in the United States' favor, mostly because of the policy reason that when multiple jurisdictions are all vying with one another, if there is an evaluation of each case under Sixth Amendment speedy trial, that would likely result in a defendant like this defendant who specifically causes the situation by committing crimes over the same period in multiple jurisdictions getting essentially a legal windfall by getting whatever those last cases are dismissed. And I see that my time's up.
One question about the record. The fact that he absconded in one case and what had happened in these other cases, that was all presented to the district court at the hearing on the motion for speedy trial?
The fact that he had absconded was not. That appears in the record in a supplemental appendix that was the PSR at sentencing. So that was part of the record. That wasn't part of the district court's decision.
It's not part of what was before the district court when it ruled.
That's right, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
I just have a couple of points. The first one is that the motion for reconsideration was resolved on.
You're going to have 2 minutes, not just 20 seconds, if you want to. I don't want to rush you.
Thank you. So the first point I'd like to make is that the motion for reconsideration was resolved on the merits. The court did address the procedural issues regarding the filing of the motion for reconsideration, but then also concluded that there was no specific prejudice from the loss of the cell phone. And that's in the record in volume one at pages 319 to 321.
Now that was an alternative ground?
Yes.
So the court rejected the motion for reconsideration on both on a procedural ground and also because it lacked merit.
That's correct, Your Honor. And then the finding was that there was no specific prejudice from the loss of the cell phone. And then regarding the government's argument that Mr. Medina didn't explain where he was, you know, on the specific dates, in his supplemental brief in support of his second motion to dismiss, that's where he goes through the counts one by one, explaining where he was and how he would like to prove his alibi for each of those counts, identifying the witnesses and what the cell phone would have shown. And that supplemental brief is in volume one, pages 378 to 391. And that's where he does this count by count analysis.
Does he also, though, include why he couldn't otherwise support his alibi with other witnesses? I think the government is arguing supplementary to their specific argument is that there was no showing that the alibi couldn't be shown through witnesses. Could I get you to address that?
Yes, Your Honor. And there are 65 pages of pro se filings following the hearing.
That's why I'm asking you.
Yes. And I'm not sure that he specifically states anywhere, you know, why those witnesses, you know, couldn't support his alibi. But apart from the fact that he can only locate his family members. But I think the problem is after 3 years, witnesses' memories fade, and therefore they're not as reliable as the cell phone would be.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Case is submitted.